has been fast-tracked, and there are real problems that could have been addressed and should be addressed.
The Mat-Su Borough Assembly approves a timber sale despite local concerns. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Friday, April 20th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Alaska Airlines tightens rules on when support animals will be allowed on flights.
We've had incidents of barking or animals running up and down the aisles. In some cases, they've bitten customers, they've bitten employees.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Raven Alaska. Raven now provides Alaskans with the day over, a 24-hour stop in any major hub along the way to a destination, including Anchorage, Kotzebue, and Bethel. More information at ravendayover.com.
Dozens of U.S. and allied warplanes are assembling at Eielson Air Force Base in preparation for an upcoming round of red flag training exercises. But F-15s from the State of Israel will not be participating, reportedly because of rising tensions in the region. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
An Eielson Air Force Base spokesman says Israel will, for the first time, be participating in a red flag training exercise. But Lieutenant Kitsana Duanlumchan says the Israeli F-15s that were scheduled to take part in the exercise that gets underway later this month won't, after all.
The Israeli Air Force will not be sending F-15s to Red Flag Alaska 18-1, which will occur from 26 April to 11 May.
Duanlumchan says he can't say anything about why Israel decided against dispatching the warplanes to Red Flag, nor how many of the fighters the nation intended to send. Israeli media, which first reported the story, say national leaders decided to keep the F-15s home due to rising tensions in the region in the aftermath of Israeli military strikes against Iranian proxies in Syria. According to the media accounts, the Israel Defense Forces have placed ground and air elements on high alert in case Iran launches a counterattack. The accounts vary in their estimates on how many of the warplanes Israel had intended to send, ranging from a handful to more than a dozen. Duanlumchan says the Israeli military will, however, take part in the upcoming red flag.
Despite this change, we're still looking forward to hosting the Israeli contingent that will be participating in Red Flag Alaska 18-1.
Duanlumchan says he can't offer any details on how the Israeli Air Force will be participating. Media accounts say Israel will send personnel and other aircraft to Red Flag, including a KC-135 tanker variant, similar to those used by the Alaska Air National Guard's 168th Air Refueling Wing that's based at Eielson. In Fairbanks, I'm Tim Ellis.
An unknown volume of diesel fuel has spilled in Savoonga. That's according to the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation, which has been dealing with more fuel spills than usual this spring. The trouble started more than a month ago at the Savoonga Native Store tank farm. During the transfer of fuel from a larger storage tank to a smaller tank, human error caused the release of 22,000 gallons of diesel heating fuel. At the time, it was believed the spill was contained and no fuel had escaped the sealed area. But Tom DeRider, state on-scene coordinator for ADEC, says, unfortunately, that's not the case.
Fuel did get out of the secondary containment area. We don't know exactly how it got out yet, and we don't have a volume of how much fuel did get out.
One thing that is certain, says DeRider, is that this complicates what would have been a relatively simple cleanup.
First of all, we need to get a relative idea of how much area has been impacted, recover any oil that can be recovered out in that area, and then we're going to have to look at springtime cleanup activities.
That means figuring out how to recover the spilled fuel from the snow and earth and then what to do with the contaminated soil. An ADEC responder will return to the St. Lawrence Island community of Savoonga soon, but first he's checking in on a few spills in Nome. In the last few weeks, ADEC has received reports of two home heating oil releases and a leak in the fuel supply line to the state office building. DeRider says he's seeing more fuel spills this spring than in an average year, and he has an idea of why that might be.
This year we've had a lot of snow.
That snow builds up on rooftops throughout the winter, and then it slips off in the spring, and it can break fuel lines.
We work on these spills, two, three of them a year, and it's just, they're always very, very difficult and expensive to get cleaned up. And the solution to it is relatively simple, and that's to move your tank away from your roof line where the snow slides off.
Cleanup is ongoing in Savunga and Nome. The Mat-Su Borough Assembly has approved a timber contract for the Chija Creek area in Trapper Creek. Many Trapper Creek residents attended the assembly meeting to express concern over what the contract will mean for local roads. KTNA's Philip Manning has more.
After 2 hours of testimony and debate on Tuesday night, the Mat-Su Borough Assembly approved a 5-year contract for a large timber harvest in the Trapper Creek area. Under the contract, timber will be cut, trucked to Port McKenzie, and shipped to China. More than a dozen Trapper Creek residents and property owners turned out for the meeting, and nearly all of them shared concerns over the contract. While almost everyone testifying says harvesting the timber could be a good thing, they also believe that the road infrastructure, specifically Oil Well Road, is simply not up to the task. Chris Wood lives on Oil Well Road and says its construction was one of expedience in the oil drilling days.
They cut trees down and laid them across the road on top of frost heaves, and they put dirt on top of it. And if the trucks didn't sink through, they moved to the next spot. That is Oil Well Road. 105,000 pounds isn't going to fly.
That figure is the estimated gross weight of a loaded timber truck. In addition, those trucks will need about 12 feet of space to maneuver safely down the road. In many places, Oil Well Road isn't much wider than that, making passing difficult. While there are plans for turnouts and clearing to increase visibility, that plan has not yet been made public. The public process in general is also a cause for criticism for some in the area of the timber harvest. Donna Massey, who serves on the Trapper Creek Road Service Area Advisory Board, says the locals should have been a bigger part of the process for the new contract.
Why can't we have a public hearing in our community with the community council be listened to? If it had happened at the beginning of this, we would not be here tonight. It would have been solved on a local level. You would have had a good process. This is not a good process.
A third source of criticism is what happened the last time Chijik Creek was leased. Ronnie Bell, who owns property on Oil Well Road, says evidence of poor execution of the last timber contract is right out in the open as you drive.
And you've seen all the logs laying out there, all the waste. And it's still laying there. Is this going to be a summary of the next thing that's going to happen again?
Not everyone spoke against the contract. Don Dyer, head of the Mat-Su Economic Development Corporation, says revenue from the contract, particularly to Port McKenzie, is very important.
$1 million a year of revenue to this borough. Revenue that pays for the lifestyle for people in Trappers Creek and Talkeetna. And for the rest of the borough, it pays for our schools.
The public testimony had a clear impact on the Borough Assembly. Assemblymember George McKee says he supports the concept, but that there are too many unanswered questions.
It has been fast-tracked, and there are real problems that could have been addressed and should be addressed. The transportation problem is something that has to be addressed.
While the contract is now approved, it won't go into effect until the borough's planning department approves a transportation plan. After a lengthy debate over whether that approval should rest with the assembly instead of staff, a promise from borough manager John Moosey to report on the public feedback regarding the plan before its approval was enough to sway all but assembly members George McKee and Jim Sykes. Once the borough releases the proposed transportation plan, the public has 30 days to comment. In Talkeetna, I'm Philip Manning.
The Alaska Department of Natural Resources made two announcements yesterday related to mineral development in Bristol Bay. First, the state has renewed Pebble Limited Partnership's land use permit for its mineral claims northwest of Iliamna. For the first time in 5 years, the state is authorizing new exploration at the deposit. The one-year permit will allow Pebble to drill up to 80 boreholes to collect information for development planning and resource modeling. The permit also authorizes reclamation activities. When the DNR granted Pebble's previous land use permit last year, it stipulated that the partnership close 142 boreholes. DNR also agreed to more site inspections and added a $2 million bonding requirement for cleanup in the event that Pebble folds. DNR said Pebble has complied in closing the 142 boreholes. The state will continue to inspect the site this year, and Pebble will again be required to put up a $2 million bond. Pebble has said it intends to begin activity at the beginning of May and continue through the end of December. The second announcement from DNR yesterday is that it will reestablish the Bristol Bay Advisory Group. The group was originally formed to provide input on the 1984 Bristol Bay Area Plan. That plan designated primary uses and management guidelines for state lands within Bristol Bay, including management of mineral development in the area. The DNR says it anticipates the reestablished advisory group will review and may recommend changes to the 1984 plan. There will be a public meeting in the Bristol Bay region to gather input on the scope of the advisory group. Members of the group will be selected through an application process. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, what's up with the barefoot guy in Juneau?
Stuff like this, I'm probably better off than most people in shoes. Actual real ice, not so much.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska, offering online and mobile services to help Alaskans and their businesses bank on the go. Learn how experience and knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com.
Today, students organized across the country in solidarity with national high school walkouts, expressing alarm over gun violence, including in communities in Alaska. In Fairbanks, participating students didn't have permission from the Fairbanks North Star Borough School District.
We have heard some of our students are organizing protest that they would be planning on walking out of class at 1:30. That means they'll be missing 45 minutes of class time.
District spokeswoman Cherise Walker says the district doesn't have a policy on such events as the walkout, and she says the district supports the students' efforts to bring attention to issues they feel strongly about. She says students who want to participate in today's walkout should get their parents to call in.
Of course, parents are welcome to call and excuse those absences if they so choose.
The walkout was scheduled for today because April 20th is the 19th anniversary of the 1999 shooting at Columbine High School in Colorado, when two students killed 13 others before shooting themselves to death. Local student organizers say the walkout also is being held in solidarity with ongoing efforts by students at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Florida to compel state and national leaders to enact legislation and policies to reduce gun violence. Electric cars and prototypes for electric trucks and planes exist. Are electric ferries coming next? The budget recently signed by Washington State Governor Jay Inslee includes money to look at converting some of its ferry fleet. Northwest News Network correspondent Tom Bonsi reports.
The legislature gave $600,000 to Washington State Ferries to explore how to convert three ferries from diesel to hybrid electric propulsion. Director of Vessels Matt Von Ruden says the money will boost a nascent vessel electrification project.
Well, we've done pre-design studies already to look at the vessels and the terminals and the charging of the vessels. And so we're ready now to move forward and actually engage industry on the solution.
That solution appears to be to install massive banks of batteries below deck on the three largest of the 22 active vessels in the fleet. Von Ruden says the technology has evolved sufficiently such that battery power alone can propel jumbo ferries across Puget Sound, although the converted ferries would still have backup diesel generators on board. I'm Tom Bonsi reporting.
While Washington State is looking into electrically powered ferries, Alaska is not. But officials here are considering another alternative fuel. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
Alaska's nine working ferries all burn diesel. That's expensive, and it contributes to climate change, which melts sea ice and permafrost, which damages roads and communities. So it would make sense for the state ferry system to look for alternatives, such as electricity.
You know, actually, it's not a new question. This question has come up in years past with the Marine Highway.
Captain John Falvey is general manager of the Alaska Marine Highway System. He says research showed it would be much harder to make electrical engines work in his fleet.
Because we run longer on average routes than Washington State Ferries does, with their entire fleet being a day fleet where they will stop once a day to be able to recharge those batteries. Makes it a little tougher, for the Marine Highway.
Falvey says the most likely candidate to be converted would be the ferry Lituya. The small ship sails a short route connecting Ketchikan and Metlakatla in southern southeast. He says electric engines might also work in Prince William Sound and Northern Lynn Canal. Both have some short routes. But the cost would be high at a time when the ferry system barely has enough money to keep its fleet sailing. He says other challenges include the time needed to recharge batteries and the availability of cheap electricity at some ports. Alaska's ferry system is planning for a different alternative fuel. Falvey says it's liquefied natural gas.
Right now, LNG is cheaper than diesel fuel and it burns a lot cleaner. So we are seriously looking at that.
The Marine Highway is installing engines on two Alaska-class ferries that will burn either diesel or natural gas. The small ships will link Juneau, Haines, and Skagway. Falvey says it's also installing dual-fuel engines on the larger ferry Matanuska. The same will happen when a replacement for the large ferry Tustamina is built.
Some of the issues with LNG is, in the past, it's been supply chain coming into Alaska, but it appears that, you know, as time goes by, that may become less and less of a problem.
He also says onboard storage could be tricky. Safety rules are very strict and have limited LNG use on passenger vessels. But he says those rules are evolving, and cruise ships that run on natural gas are being built and put into service. I'm Ed Schoenfeld, reporting in Juneau.
Alaska Airlines has announced a new policy to limit emotional support animals on airplanes. A passenger is already required to have a letter from a mental health professional and a health certificate for the animal, but starting May 1st, they'll also need a signed affidavit that the animal is trained to behave in public and the owner accepts liability for its actions. They'll have to provide all of this to the airline at least 48 hours before the flight. Alaska Airlines spokesman Tim Thompson says the changes are in response to increasing problems with emotional support animals on planes.
We've had incidents of barking or animals running up and down the aisles. In some cases, they've bitten customers, they've bitten employees.
The new policy does not affect certified service animals, which are typically dogs helping owners with physical disabilities. The new restrictions only apply to animals assisting emotional, psychiatric, cognitive, or psychological disabilities. The policy change also limits the kinds of animals allowed.
So now we're not allowing amphibians, goats, animals with tusks, horns, hooves. There is an exception for trained miniature horses.
That's on top of the animals already prohibited by the airline, including hedgehogs, ferrets, insects, rodents, snakes, or spiders.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, sustaining Alaska's pipeline for 40 years and counting. Curious about your alcohol habits or those of someone you care about? Find a free and confidential alcohol screening at recoveralaska.org or call 211 today. This Alcohol Awareness Month, Recover Alaska reminds us that together we are stronger than alcohol addiction. Recover Alaska is a trusted source for alcohol research and resources, including an index of local available treatment options. This message sponsored by Recover Alaska.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Dave Waldron. This week on AK, barefoot in Juneau. Just about any Southeast Alaskan needs a good pair of extra tufts to survive, but apparently not the Juneau resident known to many simply as the barefoot guy. He can be seen in all seasons, walking along icy sidewalks downtown or on muddy mountain trails. KTOO's Adeline Baxter met up with the man to learn why he forswears footwear and how he manages to make do without it.
Michael Boyer lives in the neighborhood above Juneau Douglas High School. He walks his dog or with his kids daily, and he's noticed a certain walker who also frequents the area.
Rain, shine, 10 degrees, 70 degrees, never any shoes.
He's never approached the man himself, but Boyer says he's been the source of much speculation for him and his friends.
Oh yeah, barefoot guy. What's the story? Is he a hobbit? Is he into New Age spiritual stuff? Don't his feet get cold?
One 30-degree day, I had my own sighting downtown near the state office building. The ground was slick with ice, and across the street a bearded man in cargo shorts was walking without shoes. I introduced myself, and he laughed in a not-again kind of way. His real name is Ezra Strong, and he agreed to go on a hike with me.
I usually take a couple walks a day. Yes, I walk a lot. So this is my third, fourth one today.
Strong grew up in Tenekee, the youngest of six kids, and works in IT for the Juneau School District, where he has to wear sandals. He's got a book with him for the hike, just something he pulled off the shelf at home. He often reads while he walks. As we set off, I noticed pretty quickly that Strong seems to fare better than I do in a lot of the slushy spots.
Stuff like this, I'm probably better off than most people in shoes. Actual real ice, not so much.
He'd love it if they made micro spikes for bare feet, but he makes do. Gravel sticking to his feet is probably the most annoying thing he deals with. But why go barefoot?
My right foot is defective. I was born with a birth defect, apparently. I think it has something to do with the shape of the arch.
One of his older brothers had the same issue. Doctors told his parents the solution was to break the foot and reset it. So they did, and it worked. But by the time Strong came along, his mom hesitated.
I guess she didn't want to have to put another kid through having his foot broken, so they just never did it to me. So getting stuff that fit me was a pain.
Basically, Strong's right foot is abnormally wide, and there just aren't a lot of options for people with weirdly shaped feet. As a kid growing up in a rural community, running around without shoes was no big deal. Then he moved to Fairbanks for college. Winters were colder, and he didn't have a car. For the first time, his feet started drawing attention. A reporter for the student newspaper at the University of Alaska Fairbanks did a story on him. Then the questions really started up.
Facebook and that sort of thing were just becoming a thing. I started getting these weird emails from people on the East Coast who had read this.
He doesn't understand the fascination. For him, it's always been about comfort. He's experimented with different sizes, styles, and brands, but nothing really works. He does own a pair of 15-year-old running shoes. They're about two sizes too big, and the sides are almost worn away.
The shoes hurt pretty bad, too, but to have the shoe pain for 15 minutes to go jogging than it is to deal with having a shattered callus for the next 3 days.
Strong's no stranger to mild frostbite, cuts, infections, and cracked heels. He uses over-the-counter products like Flexitol, a cream with shea butter and aloe, to help heal. But it's not as easy as it used to be.
As I get older, my theory again is my body takes a little longer to recover and a little longer to repair, so it's been getting worse.
Not long ago, he reached out to a California startup company that 3D prints shoes. Their custom sizing model seemed promising, but they told him they're in the middle of a transition period and not accepting orders. Strong says he's hopeful technology will eventually catch up to his feet. In the meantime, it's not all bad.
I have to say, I love being a bad influence for children. The idea to these children that you don't have to wear shoes for your entire life seems to startle them. And I have seen more than one child, when they see me pass, sit down on the sidewalk or on the beach and start trying to pull off their own shoes.
I wouldn't be a good reporter if I didn't give the barefoot thing a try. So I waited for it to warm up a bit first, and then headed out onto a trail. It's about 40 degrees and raining right now in Juneau, and I'm walking barefoot along a trail in Cope Park. My editor strongly encouraged me to try the barefoot thing out myself, and kind of hate him right now. My toes are very pink. The bottom of my feet are coated in pine needles. Ow. But anyway, now I can say I've tried it. The barefoot hiking thing, and I don't think it's for me.
For AK, I'm Adeline Baxter, and I think I'll stick with shoes.
Adeline, thank you for being a good sport. And now it's time for 49 Voices. This week we're hearing from Victoria Peterson in Anchorage. Peterson is our intern this spring, and next week she'll be launching the print version of her hyper-local news blog, The Spinardian.
I was born and raised in Spinard, and I know that neighborhood very well, and I wanted to know my neighbors better, and I wanted to know my place better. And I think the best way to do that is to just completely immerse yourself in the neighborhood and report the stories like you think are important for those people, and let those people report on the stories that are important to them as well. And giving them a medium to do that has been really satisfying. It's important for the people who live there that are knowing on that they know what's going on with their community council, different resolutions that they're passing, different things that are opening up or shutting down in their neighborhood, or things that people who live there are always going to want to know first. The history is my favorite part about Spinard because it's just wild. So the city of Anchorage was, you know, built as a railroad town to start building the railroad, developing Alaska, and Spinard was just on the outskirts of that. They didn't have the same liquor laws or any laws really in Spinard, so all the bootlegging that went on there, there's tunnels to this day that still run under the streets of Spinard that were for bootlegging or for God knows what. So it's just, it's a very like interesting, secretive, kind of Wild West sort of history that they got going, that we have going on in Spinard. I think generally people look down on it or think that it's like a shady part of town, or, you know, it's Anchorage's old red light district, and it's always going to be Anchorage's old red light district, but it's not that anymore necessarily. And not necessarily changing the way people think about the neighborhood, but inviting different perceptions of that and showing them what is really going on. I think it's really a catalyst of community for, you know, it's like a really, it's a community effort for sure, because it's not just me anymore, it's other people helping. It's hard, especially in this journalistic climate and this economic climate today, but, you know, you have people who are really passionate about it, and I mean, I do it out of my pocket, and, you know, I barely make even sometimes, but it doesn't matter because I love it, and I do it for, I would do it for free forever because it's just something I care about.
Victoria Peterson lives in Anchorage. 49 Voices is AK's attempt to put every Alaskan on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Adeline Baxter and Wesley Early. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Dave Waldron.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org/news. We had reports tonight from Tim Ellis in Fairbanks, Avery Lill in Casey Grove in Anchorage, Zoe Gruskin in Nome, Philip Manning in Talkeetna, Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, and Tom Bonsi in Washington State. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
ConocoPhillips, investing and exploring on the North Slope and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, unlocking Alaska's energy resources.
And by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com.
4 out of 5 Alaskans addicted to heroin started by using prescription opioids. Common opioids include hydrocodone, oxycodone, morphine, fentanyl, and codeine. Safely getting rid of unused opioid medication prevents anyone from taking them without permission, which could endanger them and lead to consequences with law enforcement. Find out more at opioids.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska Department of Health and Social Services. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.